Hello.
How are you?
Doing just fine.
Are you? Are you really?
Reading the PDF spec sheet for the Thompson Grass Valley Viper film stream camera system from, I don't know, whenever the hell they came out of this camera, 2004 or something. Very ugly camera.
Was that what they shot this thing on?
Yeah, it is.
Okay.
The first cameras where they tried to like make it look like the recorder was like a film mag attached to this like 2-inch wide fiber optic cable nonsense.
Oh, it sounds gross. Viper was what they used for like George Lucas's Phantom Menace-y garbagey stuff. Not Phantom Menace, Attack of the Clones and all that, right?
No, I think those were still Sony cams. Or at least I know Phantom Menace was the first, like the F900, and then I think they went to the 950. Okay. I don't know that they shot any of the Star Warses on the Viper. This had a very short-lived career, this camera.
Like the TV show. You ever watch Viper?
Is that the helicopter one?
No, that's Airwolf. Viper was the Dodge Viper that could transform and like turn invisible.
Wait, what?
It was an early 90s show. They just had like a video toaster and went wild with their Dodge Viper, and so they had it like turn invisible and it could like go super fast and stuff. It was sort of like an updated Knight Rider kind of a thing. Airwolf was the helicopter one. That was still 80s Knight Rider era where they had a tricked out helicopter that they would all get into, and it was like they did some sort of like a volcano base or something for it. Anyway,
well, where else would you put it?
I don't know exactly. You need somewhere decent to store that sort of technology.
It seems like they bring that kind of concept back every so often, because they actually brought back Knight Rider at one point, which was bad.
Yeah,
but I think I just saw a tweet go by from Variety that they're bringing back Magnum PI. I don't know if it's the same concept or not.
They had announced that earlier, and they have today they cast somebody. They announced the casting of somebody, and it's somebody who was on the Hawaii 5-0 that CBS rebooted, and it's apparently the same creative team behind the Hawaii 5-0 reboot is doing the Magnum PI reboot, which I guess makes sense since Hawaii. But the weird thing about
is Hawaii 5-0 still on TV?
It could be. I'm going to be perfectly honest. I watch not a lot of CBS, if at all possible, or if I can help it. The only thing that CBS produces that I watch is on their exclusive digital streaming platform, and that is the new Star Trek. The rest of it is unappealing to me as a consumer of content. The funny thing about the CBS reboot thing is that Dan Morin and some of the other people were talking in the Incomparable Slack about what this means for a connected CBS universe, since it's this same actor guy. And I was like, well, you know what? They already did like the NCIS crossover with Scorpion, and they did the NCIS crossover with Criminal Minds. Like, it's basically just like one big CBS expanded universe of crime solving procedural shows.
The LL Cool J cinematic universe.
Yeah, and Magnum PI even had a crossover with Murder, She Wrote back in the 80s. So, or was it like 91 or something? Anyway, so they do these things, these networks, where they have their shows crisscross. Applesauce.
So you're gonna see the Murder, She Wrote lady in a Star Trek?
I'm not sure that's technically the implication of that, but I don't think
they could go back in time to help her solve a mystery or something.
I'm not sure they would be up for rebooting Murder, She Wrote at this juncture. But never count CBS out of any decisions, good or otherwise. So anyway, that's the news. the topical news conversation.
Now to Greg with sports. So. Oh boy, you wanna get into how your weekend went, or you just want to get into the movie?
Yeah, I flew.
I feel like you might have some feedback or some notes.
I flew on an airplane to Phoenix, mm-hmm. And One thing that I think a lot of people who aren't familiar with Phoenix don't understand, including myself, is that everything in Phoenix is very far away from everything else in Phoenix.
I've never said that before ever in my entire life.
No, you've never said anything along those lines, certainly not even in the first episode of this show. But yeah, for reasons that have become more clear to me over time, it is there are long distances. And sometimes there's traffic on occasion, but it seems most of the time we're so far out from everything that it's just the general remoteness of where we're staying that causes
delay. Yeah, stuff will still take 40 minutes, but you'll be going 80 miles an hour the whole time to get there.
Yeah, which is exciting, I suppose, for some people. But yeah, we did a hiking thing up at the Tom's Thumb rock formation mountain hill thing. Anyway, that was...
Is that on Camelback Mountain, or is that different?
No, that's different, because we were going to do Camelback, because that was the part of the reason why Jason had picked the resort we stayed at, was like, oh, it's near this mountain he'd always wanted to go on. He did not check the trail rating for that. Supposedly, there's no way to actually ascend other than rock climbing. so that rule...
I don't know about that. There's probably no like paved trail for portions of it, but I don't think it's that steep.
Well, there are portions of it, if you actually want to get all the way to the top, there are portions of it that require rock climbing. Not the entire time from the parking lot up, but there are portions that require rock climbing. And I was like, you know, probably not up for that. And he's like, yeah, TBH, me neither. And so he looked up other trails, and he came upon this Tom's Thumb thing, and it was either that or some other thing that was near the Four Seasons or whatever up there, and it was just like, well, they're equidistant, which one do you want? And instead of picking the one that I think had the cooler name, it was like Pinnacle Point or Pinnacle Peak or something.
Pinnacle Peak
instead of it, which isn't a pinnacle. The peak isn't a peak a pinnacle? Like what are we doing with words here, Arizona?
We don't know. It's probably another one of those ones that was named after a derogatory Native American term and then was hastily renamed to something else terrible.
Yeah. Well, anyway, we went to Tom's Thumb, which is a great name. And
there's a gas station that has good barbecue near there, according to Triple D, but I've never been up there.
Oh, that's that one? I've seen that episode of Triple D, but...
Yeah, the gas station with the barbecue place.
Oh, yeah. We weren't in the mood for barbecue because it was a little early. We generally don't eat at gas stations, but
you didn't need any gas either.
we got the gas on the way back to the airport, but we ascended that, and that was high. And my quad still hurt from that. And we went back down the mountain and hung out at the pool for a little bit before we met up with you and Amanda at a tiki bar, a secret tiki bar, which is not
a
really
secret underground tiki bar.
It was literally underground, but it was not really like a well kept secret, I would say, because as you and I both noted, the palm fronds kind of give it away.
I mean, it's like a well kept secret in that there is literally no signage outside, and you just have to kind of like Google it to figure it out where it is. And I've never heard of it before, but I don't know. That's not surprising. I don't go seeking out a lot of tiki bars.
Yeah, well, I think you had messaged Dan or Amanda had messaged, I'm sorry, you had messaged Jason or Amanda had messaged Jason about how wanting to go to some undertow thing or whatever. And at least that's according to him how he got the idea in his head about undertow. And
I think he sent me something on Instagram and said, oh, this looks cool, will you go here with us? And I was like, yeah, sure. That's
okay.
That's cool.
Well, anyway,
I think we
went to undertow, and we were unfortunately a couple minutes late, and they gave away our reserved bar stools, so we had to stand for a bit. But we got to witness the video screen portholes that lined the walls in this tiny ship cabin thing.
It was, really added to the atmosphere.
They went a little further than most tiki bars in the ambiance side of things.
There were war drums and all kinds of things.
All kinds of cultural appropriation. We had our tiki bevs, and you had something that was basically just straight alcohol both of the times that you ordered a drink.
It was very strong, and then the other one tasted like a plant or some, I don't know what it was. It tasted odd.
I thought it tasted like gasoline.
The coffee shop above, where the Tiki Bar is a converted auto repair shop, which I think they kind of they saw like where you pull your car in and then like they have the stairs that go underneath the car so you can like change the oil of the car really easily. They're like, hey, we've got this sort of like built-in underground space down here and we're not going to be changing the oil of any cars in the coffee shop now. What can we put down here? I got an underground Tiki Bar. So it's all, you know, they just used what they had right there.
Oh, that's it's very wise. Your people sure. use every part of the gas station. So we were in the gas station underground area, and we had the BEVs, and they were quite good. And then we went across the street to a place that Dan had recommended called Beckett's Table. And I tried to stay out of the decision making process because I'm not the person responsible for ultimately casting the final vote on anything.
Yeah, me neither. I don't decide those things either.
No. So I had just taken Dan's wrecks and dumped them, and I'd been informed that several of them were chains that were available to us in Los Angeles, so they were ruled marked right off the list. And then we went with that one. That was the Beckett's Table one. And there was a live musical thing happening with a lady doing her own loop vocal performance.
She was beatboxing her own, I don't know, drum/bass section to go with her wistful singing.
Yeah, it was sort of Dido-esque. And we had some stuff, and then we went and had some sundaes over at the Sweet Republic, and we parted ways. Mm-hmm, and then mm-hmm. It was too cold for us, and our flight was delayed, and I watched Black Panther.
Yes. Mm-hmm. You came the one week into the year where it's cold and cloudy.
Yeah, I mean, it was also cold and cloudy, apparently, in Los Angeles. You know, not that they're terribly far apart from one another, but usually it's warm in one of them. And that was a little bit of a disappointment because... It would have been nice to have just a modicum of sun, but it was pretty gloomy and windy and gross.
Colder and windier today, I think, too. It's still currently 63.5 degrees, 31% humidity in my office right here.
It's 74 in my apartment, and it's 29% humidity.
That sounds pretty good.
Well, except I tried to make Zha Zhimeng Are you familiar
with the singer
with
the big poofy hair?
Yes. It was very difficult to make them. It's a Chinese black bean sauce with cold noodles and cucumber on it. Only I tried to do a paleo and so that involved
you just took the noodles out.
It was zoodles. It was
cold noodles and cucumbers is never a good combination.
Actually, it's really good. It's when done properly, and this was not, it's quite good and quite refreshing. I'm not going to do that again at home, mostly because my apartment still smells like black bean sauce, which is quite fragrant because it's soybeans that are fermented, so that's what turns them black. So it's not like you know, the traditional turtle beans or something that you would get in Mexican or Cuban fare. They're fermented.
No black eyed peas in your zoodles?
No.
Shame.
Yeah, sorry.
Do you think your apartment didn't
party like it was, you know? Anyway, what were you going to say?
I was going to say, do you think your black bean sauce smells worse than cooked squirrel or better?
I'm not qualified to answer that because I've not been around a lot of cooked squirrel. I'm going to have to leave that one up to the true artists.
The Santa Rosa Police Department can make that.
Oh man, that must have been a sight. So anyway, using our little varmint to pivot around, let's move on to the movie that we're discussing this week, Zodiac, which I had never seen prior to this. Dan, you've been super super jazzed, I would say. Elated.
I wouldn't say
amped.
Elated. I said I suggested it, and well, I don't even know if I suggested it this time. It was on Prime, and you said, "How about Zodiac?" And I'm always going to jump at the chance to talk about a gloomy Fincher movie. So, like, yep, of course, yep, totally in. Like, we don't even have to discuss it. But this being the continuation of our theme of Gyllenbrewery, I feel like this movie might need to be disqualified from Gyllenbrewery because it is very light on the Gyllenhaal.
I
mean, he's there a lot, but it's not. This isn't really his movie. This isn't really anybody's movie. It's an ensemble movie, obviously. Based on the story, it kind of has to be. But I don't know. I mean, he's certainly, in my opinion, probably the least interesting character in the movie.
But he is our viewpoint for the film.
I mean, he's a viewpoint. He's kind of an insane viewpoint.
No, but what I mean is the audience, our vantage point, is mostly through the things that he is seeing and experiencing in the film.
On the outside looking in on the police and unable to really get involved, I suppose.
Yeah, and that mostly is because of who did the material that this was based on, because he wrote a book about his research that he did, the character that Jake Gyllenhaal plays. So that, you know, influences their perspective of the film. Jake
Just
Gyllenhaal,
like The Social Network, except they don't really do it very well in that one.
Yeah, but Jake Gyllenhaal is not, as you said, he's not super interesting. He's pretty naive and inexperienced and sheltered and
he's an Eagle Scout.
Oh, yeah, and he doesn't seem to have any pizzazz in any way. I'm not sure what Chloe Sweeney saw in him, but, you know.
Like she said at the end there, because there are a couple of themes from the beginning of the movie that they have to tie into the end of the movie to make it a capital M movie, where she said, you know, it was just a date that went on too long because she was intrigued by the fact that he was involved in the Zodiac-iness.
Yeah, and I can understand how that would wear on somebody at a certain point, and it did wear on me at a certain point. I'm going to be perfectly honest with you. This movie is too long. This movie is way too long. This movie is not focused around what it really is trying to do or say. So you're getting an enormous scope. You're getting this huge swath of time that you're trying to cover. And there is a part in the first 45 minutes of this film where you're just like, 2 days later, 2 weeks later, 1 week later, 2 weeks later, 3 days later, 4 days later, 1 week later, 4 months later, 2 days later. And it's just like, I can't process this. Like,
it doesn't matter really. It's, you know, except when they jump forward like 1 year or 4 years at a time, it really doesn't matter that much, I don't think.
No, well, that seemed to happen more towards the second and third act, I would say, where
sure, yeah.
The jumps in time were less frequent because the Zodiac killing stuff was happening less often, and it was mostly from the perspective of the people investigating what was going on. So it gave you some space to process things. However, there's a lot of that stuff in the beginning where, even though I'm saying that it's cut together in a very one than the other kind of a way, the pacing of the editing there is not like that. The pacing of the editing can be kind of leisurely. So you have very long, detailed scenes about the murders that go on for quite a while and have slow motion blood splatter death shots for several people.
Well, the murders, yeah, the investigation is not really drawn out that much.
No, but they're lovingly shot, I should say. Like, if you are squeamish about murder, avert your eyes, because this is a movie about murder.
Yeah, the one at the lake still gets to me because it's just kind of brutal.
Yeah, I mean, there's just something about the stabbing stuff that,
yeah, knife murder like right in the center of frame is not super pleasant.
Yeah, I mean, and it's supposed to be unpleasant. Like, that is obviously what David Fincher's going for. I don't think he made an oopsie. It's just I don't need personally that level of intimacy with murder.
Yeah,
on screen.
There's some interesting things about this, trying to put it in perspective, because this being something in the 70s, this is not something that you or I lived through. I mean, technically, the story ends in 1991 or whatever, but so we were there. But the vast majority of the public hysteria was before our time. But this was during Fincher's time, and he actually lived in Marin County when this was happening, and I think he has a very personal connection to a lot of the feelings and events around this time. So the way he chooses to emphasize some of the disturbing and tense and stressful scenes, I think has a lot of meaning to him and probably some of the people who were there at the time, of just, you know, just how much menace could be lurking around kind of any sort of corner. Like, you know, the really weird scene with the projectionist guy and Jake at the end there, where think it's going to be a turn, it turns out, or you know, an aha or something, and it's like a double turns out because there's nothing there. It really is kind of like presented in such a way that you think something's bad's going to happen, but you think it might be too convenient because it is, so you don't know if it's going to happen. And it's really just amping up the tension as much as it possibly can, without any sort of a release, which I guess, you know, sort of is emblematic of what you would be feeling at that time, especially if you had no idea what was actually going to happen. But yeah, some of those moments kind of they ring a little, I don't know, they're not as affecting to me, I guess, personally, other than, you know, I speak movie language and I understand the syntax of tension and stuff like that.
Uh-huh. Yeah, well, I think he does a very good job at building tension in this film. And I don't know how much of that is just because he'll wear you down with a bunch of close-ups of things and then finally just go on to the actual, like,
I watched
the
YouTube
part.
Video where they said he only does close-ups on things that are very important.
He does close-ups on lots of stuff. But he seems to do it to, like, I don't know. Right before all these tense scenes happen, there is just a lot of really tightly framed close shots. So there's not a lot of space, and so everything that's in the frame seems important. And so you think the door is important. You think the basement door is important. You think the light that he's turning off is important. You think the thing he's holding in his hand is important. You think the fact that you can't see him as he goes right behind the little thingy is, like, it's done on purpose, the way that he does all of this. They're not accidents. And it's definitely done in a way that effectively builds tension, because you don't have any release leading up to that, because it's just been really tight close-up stuff all the way to the point where it's finally like, oh, well, that thing's over. You're just paranoid.
Yeah, no. And the thing about it is, like, not only is that, like, on the one hand, it's frustrating as a viewer to have that experience, but on the other hand, that actually really does kind of serve the story, because the whole idea is that you really have no idea what is or isn't important, and what will, you know, be a break, or what will reveal something and what won't, or what's true and what's fake. And, you know, it's really, you know, the story is that this investigation is technically still open because it was never fully solved. Like, they could never put enough hard evidence down in one place to actually pin it on one particular person, even though by the time they get to the end, they do basically figure out who it is. And the only way that they can actually move the story forward is to write this book about everything that they've, you know, figured out, and just put it out there publicly and say, like, hey, this is what we know. We can't prove it legally. And then that sort of spurs the investigation to go on at sort of like a federal level. I think that guy at the end there is a Department of Justice fellow or something, but like that whole building tension with no release, that's like the whole thing in the movie here.
Yeah, he seemed like the a guy from earlier on who was partnered when they went down to Riverside, I think, the first time or something. I don't know, he seemed familiar, but I could be misplacing him. I certainly wasn't expecting Always Sunny Westworld guy to be the older version of the guy from the first scene, but
oh, right, yes. Milky from Always Sunny.
Yeah. But the movie starts with old Warner Brothers and old Paramount Studios logos, which is interesting because they're trying to go for that period feel. However, Warner Brothers and Paramount Pictures would have never jointly released anything before. That's just because of the distribution deal that they had in the mid-2000s.
Get your inside baseball out of here. You don't know that.
I do. I worked on Beowulf, which was also a picture that they jointly released.
Equally as popular as this movie.
No. What if David Fincher did Beowulf? But anyway.
You know, that kind of breaks my brain, but also he was going to do 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, so that's equally as absurd a project for him to do.
Well, remember when Ridley Scott was going to do the Monopoly movie?
No. What Monopoly movie?
He was attached, quote unquote, to the Monopoly movie. But
is it like an emoji movie but with Monopoly?
Yeah, well, remember when they were greenlighting all those like board games, Battleship, etc. They had greenlit a Monopoly movie with Ridley Scott. I think he was just taking their money.
Yeah, for sure. Wait, who did Battleship? That was a big name director, wasn't it? Oh, that was that was what's his name.
Yeah, Berger something, right?
Yeah, what's Peter Berg. Yes. Peter ILM gets all of our budget money.
Yeah. He's an unpleasant fellow who can't really do a good job directing a movie. So,
I mean, he's okay for what he is. He's just, he doesn't know what he's talking about sometimes.
Which is, I find, something I look for in a director. But anyway,
he's old school, Joe.
That is neither here nor there. Let's get back to this old school movie.
Sure, sure.
Because we get the San Francisco as it was in the day. We get
the freeway
fireworks
around the Embarcadero there by the ferry building with that nice. Like, there's some cool. There's a lot of CG in this movie, especially some of the wide establishing shots. But they're pretty cool. Like, you got the fireworks over the bay there for the 4th of July in the opening. You got that like super smooth flying into the ferry building. You got the time-lapse CG of the Transamerica building being built there. There's a lot of cool stuff in San Francisco here.
Yeah, I mean, this movie, I think, probably inspired the Arrow screensavers on the Apple TV. But
this movie is moody AF, is another way to say it, too.
Yeah, it's very atmospheric in that it helps put you in a place because the Embarcadero doesn't exist anymore. The Transamerica building has always been there, according to like most adults' viewpoints. If you're not from earlier than the 70s, so it can be jarring to see these things just sort of materialize over time. And there are also larger than life characters, which we are unfamiliar with as a modern audience, which come into play in this film.
You're talking about Brian Cox?
Yes, Brian Cox as Melvin Belli, who was apparently an infamous personal injury attorney in the Bay Area, and also had acting aspirations and liked Star Trek. And so there's even a scene in here where Brian Cox, as Melvin Belli, is making small talk with the news anchor about how it's too bad Star Trek was canceled because he played Gorgon in an episode. Which is,
say, like, a lot of good people there. Real shame what happened or something.
Yeah. The third season of Star Trek was mostly garbage. And they had the whole upheaval with producers, and Gene Roddenberry had stepped away, and there was just, like, a lot of terrible things were put on screen, including the episode that Melvin Belli was in, where he played the bad guy who was the personification of evil that these children chanted into existence, and he was manipulating the children to believing in him and then psychic powers, etc. It was bad. It was really bad. I even just watched it now before we recorded. It was like, is this as bad as I remember? And I was like, oh God, this is so bad. And so I just like turned away and I started cooking my terrible dinner for some of these scenes, because William Shatner's acting is like, I don't know, it's like he needs a good director who can pull him back from community theater, because he goes there sometimes.
Well, I'm sure he would love working with David Finch. Did you read any of the Wikipedia or like any of the behind the scenes stuff about this movie?
No, I'm gonna assume that there were tons and 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 tons of takes.
I believe that is probably the case, probably not to the extent of some of the other movies, but there is one notable story about Mr. Robert Downey Jr., who I would like to note at the beginning of the story, has never worked with David Fincher since then, as far as I'm aware, right?
Sure.
Yeah, so you remember the scene at the bar where he makes the little pyramid out of straws?
Yes.
And then he picks it up with the other straw or whatever?
Yes.
Apparently that was his idea. And he didn't realize that he was going to have to do it 50 times. And by the end of the night, he was very, very frustrated. Or day, who knows if it was multiple days. But he was so annoyed by the fact that he had to do it so many times that he was peeing in beer bottles and leaving them around the set in protest.
I believe you've told me that story before.
You know, it's one of those things, like, you see the behind the scenes of Social Network. It's actually a moment that goes by pretty quickly where they're doing the deposition scene, and Andrew Garfield is like sitting there, and he's kind of turned sideways to the table, and he puts his left arm up on the table, and Fincher goes, "You sure you're comfortable like that? Because you're going to be sitting like that for 3 days straight." And he's like, "Yeah, I'm fine." But basically, he didn't realize that his arm is going to be up on a table for 3 days straight. Like, you can't move it for continuity purposes. It's just not the way it's going to work. You're going to sit there for 3 days with your arm elevated on a table. So that's, you know, the decisions you make as an actor, you know, it's like, all right, if you're going to commit to doing your silly little straw thing, Robert, you're going to have to do it 50 times as we do this every single time.
Well,
like that angle was used like once, too.
I have this is the thing, though, is I have a question.
Mm-hmm.
How much coverage does a good director need?
Well, based on what I can discern from some of the other behind the scenes, I don't know that I've seen the behind the scenes of Zodiac. I don't think I have. He likes to work with 2 to 4 cameras, and probably, I don't know, 6 different setups. So it would be easy to fill a whole day with shooting, but you shouldn't really be shooting the same section. Like, he doesn't shoot the same section. He doesn't shoot it start to finish every single time. So I don't know. Like, if he just did that opening section 50 times, he must have done the rest of the scene 50 times when the cameras moved to a different place.
It's just, it boggles my mind. 'Cause it's like, is that a good use of anyone's time? His time, the actor's time, the crew's time, anyone's time, the editor's time later when they're going through all of these cuts to see which one is good. Like, how many of these takes were like almost identical, but just slightly different?
I don't know. Apparently, if that was the case, I imagine this wouldn't be his process, but, you know, who knows? I don't know. I feel like the performances that came out of it are pretty good. Like, the character performances all ring pretty honest and true for characters and human beings or whatever. So I don't feel like there was something that they skimped on or that they overdid, or there was just a bad performance here or there. It's, you know, just whether or not you enjoy what the scene was and what the characters were doing and that sort of thing. And I think, you know, you mentioned a lack of charisma in Gyllenhaal, but luckily we have Robert Downey Jr. to sort of make up for everyone else's lack of charisma in this movie. So it's good that, you know, he got the opportunity to explore and do some things.
But Robert Downey Jr. as Avery is not in much of this film.
He's in plenty of the movie. I mean, he's missing from like the second-ish third act.
Yes. The second-ish third
there,
act.
He's there for the whole beginningness of it all.
Yes, the beginningness. He's big on the beginningness.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, this movie starts with a homicide that occurs where there seems to be some familiarity between the lady who's being killed and whoever has been pursuing them. There's a guy in the car. He's not murdered, although they keep referring to it as a murder. So it's unclear for some part of the film whether or not that he died after being found at the scene. But fortunately for everybody, he's alive. Then we go to the San Francisco Chronicle, and we get the viewpoint of Jake Gyllenhaal as a cartoonist. We get Robert Downey Jr. as Paul Avery, the columnist who's, I don't know, he's just a gonzo columnist. Like, he's drinking and smoking and bending all the rules, and it's all about
crime.
Yeah, but it's all about him too. Like, he's very big on him, and that is something that he even broaches. He broaches the subject of that with Jake Gyllenhaal's character, because he's like, I don't get what you're going to get out of this. Like, what's your business angle on this? Because he knows what he gets out of it, because it's column inches, and scoops and etc. But like, Jake Gyllenhaal as a cartoonist gets nothing out of it, because he's, you know, that's not the scope of his appointment.
He wants to solve a puzzle.
And he becomes obsessed with this particular puzzle. You get other characters inside the newsroom who are inconsequential. You eventually wind up with Inspector William Armstrong, played by Anthony Edwards, in a weird hairpiece, and Mark Ruffalo as Inspector David Toshi.
These are some of the things where, while I I understand that these are probably real characters and they had their individual affectations. They were probably fully laid out.
I think you mean real people, not real characters.
Whatever. Yeah, sure.
Characters welcome.
They're both. they were probably described as such in the book. Like, I really don't care if Mark Ruffalo wore bow ties all the time and had a thing for animal crackers while he was thinking on crime scenes. Like, that doesn't do anything for me, and it doesn't really add any, like, flavor to the movie to make it whimsical or anything. It was just weird.
No, yeah, I agree with you on, especially on the animal crackers, because I was like, is this going anywhere? No.
And, he's like Columbo, but he needs animal crackers to think.
But, chew your gum. The animal crackers thing, that doesn't make any sense for adding flavor, because animal crackers don't have any flavor. Like, they just... She's like,
I was drinking water. Don't do that.
Sorry, they don't taste good. Like, who is sitting around going, ah, you know what?
They weren't even the frosted crackers. They weren't even the pink and white frosted ones with the little sprinkly bits on them.
No, my mom used to buy, you know, the really tall, big bags of just the plain animal crackers.
Yes.
Are you familiar?
Like, I am familiar.
It basically looked like two or three chips bags, like stacked on top of each other in height.
Yeah.
Yeah, so she would buy that, and then they would go stale, like, the next day, because it's Florida, and it's humid.
Stale.
Yeah.
I mean, they weren't great. They were kind of like Teddy Graham's level, without kind of, like, the sweetened honey glaze on the outside. But, they weren't, the worst cracker ever.
No, these are the puffy, crispy kind, when they're not the official Barnum & Bailey, like...
Wait, puffy, crispy kind?
Yeah. There are different kinds of animal crackers, unfortunately. The kind that are more like shortbread cookies, which come in the animal cracker boxes.
Right, the Barnum's box.
Yeah. Those are, I think, my personal preferred of the animal cracker varieties that can be had. And then you got your...
Even over the frosted ones.
I just don't like frosting that much. I don't have as much of a sweet tooth. But I could understand...
Even as a child, huh?
No, not even as a child, but I could understand going for the grandma's whatever animal crackers, which I believe is like the predominant brand for that, where they would have the frosting and the sprinkles or whatever. Those ones I could understand, but these other ones are like, I don't know, like puffy, like oyster crackers, but that just vaguely sweet and vanilla flavored. They're very awful.
I'm not sure I know those ones.
Oh, I'll send you a large quantity of them, because I'm sure you can't get that just like one on Amazon. But so anyway, the thing with this is it's an affectation that goes nowhere, does nothing. We don't need it. And that's a Star Trek reference. GNDN was something that they wrote on all the pipes in the original series because they didn't know how to explain what they did.
It goes just nowhere, does nothing. That's good. That's interesting. That's a good acronym. I will continue to use that.
Yeah, because that's the animal crackers.
The animal crackers, they just serve to sort of like sorkin up the dialogue in that scene with the cab driver getting killed, because it's just sort of nonstop talking. I mean, there is a little bit of space in the dialogue to give it some air when he's, you know, walking down the street and sort of thinking a little bit about why they chose this corner and that sort of stuff. So I don't think it's like, it's not Sorkin in the sense that it's walking, talking, every second of it is crammed with dialogue. But it is just sort of like, we're going to change topics to something silly real quick and then come right back to the murder. And I guess maybe the thing we're supposed to get out of it is that, it's just another day on the beat for Mark Ruffalo. And, you know, he needs his crackers for his process or whatever. But,
yeah,
the lamp bit was kind of funny, if you can actually understand what he's saying through his like mumbliness into the phone.
Oh, but, God, he mumbles so much.
Yeah.
More like Mark Mumbleo, but so anyway,
I don't mind Mark Ruffalo. He's good.
You almost said it again. No, but he is so, I don't know. He's unintelligible for like the first third half of the film, where it's just like he's just sort of vaguely talking under his breath, and it's like what is happening? Like there are louder sound effects than his dialogue. It could be a fault of the sound mixing, but I just wish he had enunciated some things more. But you also have like the weird scene where they're at the diner and they're like, oh, you know, what's that? It's a BLT. And he takes the BLT and he takes the tomato out, because that's a character moment, is that he doesn't like tomatoes. And then he starts eating that half the BLT, and then he sends Anthony Edwards off to do that thing. And he's like, oh, are you going to finish that? And so he starts eating the fries and finishes up the rest of the BLT.
I would like to know what happened on that day of filming, because I feel like something weird happened. Because I don't know if you noticed, but in that scene, there is exactly one camera angle. And it is a weird camera angle where you can see the door and the counter and the foreground all at that sort of like tilted down and angled to the right a little bit, so everything's in position there. But there's no coverage. There's no nothing. I think there might be two lenses. Like, there's a longer lens when he comes in, and then it widens back out. But, like, it's just there. It feels very odd compared to everything else in the movie. From a directorial standpoint, it just seems like maybe this was, like, a backup location, and there was, like, nowhere else to put the camera, and they're just like, fuck it, we gotta move on. Like, there's nothing else I can do. Like, I don't understand what that scene is for the most part.
Yeah.
When you're talking about trimming time, like, that's a scene that could be trimmed for time, aside from the fact that they needed to communicate, like, who Anthony Edwards was gonna go call on the phone next. And they did it pretty quickly with a lot of back-to-back dialogue, but then, like, that scene does nothing.
Yeah, well, see, but that's what a lot of these scenes are, when we're talking about, like, the diner stuff or the animal crackers, is because they have it in there so that they're not just talking about the case from start to finish, expository dialogue delivery, in the scene. However, the flavor of what they've chosen, what they selected to add for this, is just peculiar, because then you're focused on this sandwich that he's taking apart and then half eating and then it's taking from the other guy, and it's like, that's not the point of the scene, so it detracts from the importance of this call that Anthony Edwards needs to go make. So it doesn't make any sense to me.
Yeah, I know. And as much as it's important to have a feeling and understanding of these characters and the time and the atmosphere and all that stuff, to a certain extent, like, I don't really need a ton of their home lives and these weird personal moments, because for me, the story is fascinating. Like, it, you know, it's a police procedural, but it is a very unusual police procedural in that this is an incredibly long running, like, serial killer who was never able to be, like, actually caught. And, you know, just the things that occurred and the steps and the cogs in the whole process is actually fascinating. And you don't need a ton of filler for that, but you do want to make sure that it is not, like, back to back, you know, you're not, like, TLDRing over the entire thing, and they're just, like, guys sitting around a table at the police station, like, saying, well, we know this and that, and then suddenly it's in the third act. But I don't know. There are a lot of moments like that that aren't, I don't know, maybe not a lot of moments, but that is one moment in particular where I feel like it was unnecessary. I'm sure there were some more.
Yeah, and you also have stuff where they're having their dialogue about how Anthony Edwards, you know, is probing on whether or not he's ever wanted to try Japanese sushi, the raw stuff, you know, oh, the urchin or whatever. Like, you ever want to try that? No, never. And then when they have their scene where they're breaking up as a partnership, the night of his reassignment, never telling his partner what he's doing, they wish each other well. And he's like, oh, maybe now you can go try that Japanese raw stuff that you've been looking to try. And it's like, okay. Wink, wink, we get it. Sushi wasn't big in the 70s.
Yeah, it's another one of those callback capital M movie moments or whatever, but, like, whatever, it's fine.
It's one of those things, like, Mad Men would do this, and many, like, tons of other movies that are set in earlier times, period pieces, would do, where they would, in a way to show how distant and removed it was from us, they would reference something that is common nowadays, which was uncommon back then. And it is supposed to specifically be jarring for us as the modern audience watching it. Whereas if this was a movie or something made back in the time that it was being made, that wouldn't have even been a scene. So that is another point where it's just kind of anachronistic and weird, because why do we care about that?
Yeah. I mean, I get that, like, if you have this, like, long-standing sort of mostly professional relationship against two guys who are ostensibly respect each other or friendly or whatever, that when, you know, you hear the news that he's transferring out of there because he just doesn't want to deal with it anymore, you may want to kind of deflect in sort of a slightly more pleasant, or, like, let's change the topic into just back to regular old cop banter. But, you know, the callback to the sushi thing is, I mean, it's whatever, it's there if they needed to call back to it from the beginning. Like, that may well have been one of the things that they wrote the whole script, and they're like, well, we need a moment here where he kind of deflects his being hurt that Anthony Edwards is going, so, like, what can he call back? I don't know. We'll go back in the beginning there, and, like, in the car ride, he'll just, you know, out of the blue ask something about sushi, and then at the end there, we'll bring up the sushi thing. But it's like, whatever. You can take that whole thing out of the movie, and it doesn't make a difference.
Yep.
The thing about this movie that is difficult, though, just, like, on the whole, is that these being true events that involve so many people and so many different mechanics just in terms of plot, like, it's interesting, I guess, if you want to know the whole story or if you were there or whatever, but it doesn't work great as a movie because it does not really abide by an act structure. See also The Social Network. But it's just sort of like, there's a lot of stuff. You don't really know who you're rooting for. Like, yeah, I know, you know, Jake is the audience analog, but there are large swaths of the movie that he is not even in. So it's just like, you know, really building an empathy for somebody or, like, a perspective is difficult, but you're just sort of taking all of the stuff in. And luckily, it's interesting enough visually and just sort of plot-wise to keep you going. But it's not these types of movies don't work great as movies. They work great as a story. But, like, as a movie, it just kind of, you get to the end, and you're like, wow, that was a lot of stuff.
Yeah, perhaps this would have been better suited to a serialized format of entertainment.
A serialized format of entertainment directed by David Fincher about a serial killer. What could that possibly look like?
I don't know. I'm hunting in my mind for a name right now, but
you should totally go watch that. Because one thing about Mindhunter that reminds me of this movie, which is my favorite part of the movie, is that scene where they first interview Lee at his job there, where they're all sitting around the table in the break room. That is my favorite scene in this whole movie because, like, they bring along the Vallejo sergeant dude because, like, they're on his turf and they're kind of be respectful. And he's like, is it all right if he takes the lead? And then you and me will sort of follow up. And he's like, yeah, whatever. But just as the conversation progresses and Lee is sort of like, well, you know, I told that other officer about all those bloody knives in my car. And he's just like, he's just gobsmacked that this guy is volunteering this stuff and then trying to circumvent, like, no, that was totally nothing. Like, that was just a chicken I killed earlier. And I was up there and I talked to some couple, but they were very nice and I have their name. And it just happened to be that I was diving. And I have the name, you know, my neighbor saw me, you know, he can witness that I came home that day, but he died of a heart attack. And this guy is just like, are you friggin' kidding me? You are giving us this case and then, like, pretending like we can't see that you, like, all of this lines up, the shoes and the watch and all of it. Like, I love his perspective on that scene. It's so good.
Yeah, I agree with you. That scene is shot well because there is a level of frustration that we feel for the characters in it where we are siding definitely, I think, with the detectives that this guy is guilty. And when we go to flip his place, when they finally get the warrant to search it, it confirms a lot of bad things about him.
Peculiarities. It's also, like, one of those things where, like, you don't expect it to go that way. Like, you expect him to, like, give you nothing. But not only does he not give you nothing, he gives you so much, but, like, in a very weird way that you're just like, are you kidding me? And then it gets to the end there, and he does the whole, I'm not the Zodiac, but even if I was, I wouldn't tell you. It's like, who says something like that and then walks away? Like, what is going on here?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, but as they correctly point out, they don't actually have a sufficient amount of evidence for this.
Right. And, like, presumably if he got away with the Riverside thing years ago, and then he's up until now gotten away with the other murders, like, maybe he just thinks he's really smart and it's not because, like, due process is actually difficult. Maybe he thinks his stupid lies and nonsense are actually, like, convincing to people. So he's like, yeah, totally, I'll, you know, volunteer that I was there at all of these times. No, I wasn't the guy who did it. And all of the cops are just like, you know, we talk to liars and criminals all day long. Like, we can see right through you. Do you not understand that?
Yeah. Yeah, and what is perhaps frustrating as an audience member is that there's no payoff for that or conclusion. Yeah. Also, we come to find out that there were further exchanges that character had with David Tashi, Mark Ruffalo's character, that had occurred off screen, and had been neglected until an appropriate time, as to build tension around some other suspects rather than this one, to make this one seem like more of a dead end. So I don't know. It's a weird way to pace things. And then we finally have that one scene with him at with Jake Gyllenhaal at the hardware store, where he's, I don't know, in an Ace Hardware. I have no idea what's going on.
Where he works.
And he approaches him, looks him in the eye, as he says to his wife, Chloe Sweeney, that he wants to do. He wants to look him in the eye and make sure that it's the guy. And he looks him in the eye, and he's 100% sure, and he leaves. And that's the highlight of that. And then we cut to Ontario Airport, and Jimmy Simpson is being brought into a break room, and then he points at the guy and says it was him on the thing.
Yeah.
So it's a weird way to end it, because, of course, it's a weird way that the actual case ended, or didn't. So it makes for a very strange structure for the film, because we don't really get appropriate closure that we would expect as an audience who's used to contained stories.
Yeah, generally, if you're ending with like multiple title cards and paragraphs on screen, it's not a super satisfying ending. But I mean, what are you going to do in this case?
Well. Hold the phone there. I think my friend Marty has something to say about that. You know, the ending to Goodfellas is fine.
Yeah, that wasn't like text on black though.
It was text.
Yeah.
It's like, and this is where he went in the witness protection. You don't remember? You don't remember how the movie ended?
I remember. It's fine. Like, luckily that the ending of Goodfellas, like the text on screen, it's not like, and the solution to the murder is like, that's just like, this whole story you watched up until now is screwed up. Like, it's mostly resolved, and it's just like, well, he's in witness protection. You're not looking to the text to get any resolution out of it.
Well, you are, because you saw no resolution on screen. Your resolution that you got was the hardware store.
I meant for Goodfellas. Yeah, for this movie, the only resolution you're getting is via text.
Well, the resolution that you got in Goodfellas is that he was caught, and he exposed everything else as part of a plea deal, and then that's how you got your movie.
Yeah, I know, but we saw the getting caught in the plea deal on screen.
Yeah, but that is just the further elaboration of where everything went after that. And you also find out what happened to all the other incidental characters. We should do Goodfellas sometime.
I feel like we'll get in trouble if we do that.
Why? You don't think you're going to talk about Goodfellas, right?
No, you can never talk about Goodfellas, right? Well, maybe
I would agree with that assessment.
Maybe if we do Marchton Scorsese, we can throw Goodfellas in there. We'll see.
Yeah, we'll see how that goes. So anyway, the ending to this movie, I just think is weird and clunky and strange, and especially with the bizarro structure of how things unfold in here.
Although, to be honest, like, if you lived through this time, there was probably so much confusion and misinformation and rumor about what actually happened that this movie is probably very concise and clear for what actually happened, and explains a lot of, you know, what really went down back then. Like, you know, not having been there, this seems like a jumbled mess, but compared to like everyone that would have been writing and talking about this, this is probably a pretty, pretty straight through line for what happened.
Yeah, I suppose so. But my point is, as a block of cinematic entertainment that you are meant to consume.
Yeah, it's difficult.
Yeah. Whereas I feel like this could be better served in a format that was serialized, where you could break it up into chunks and tell more discrete stories around certain parts of this chronological thing, rather than being forced to frame an entire film around what is the total span of this, 14 years, something like that, from Gyllenhaal's point of view in the film?
The first murder was like 68.
Yeah.
So 68 to 91. That's long time.
It's a while. Yeah, because they even have that line. What is it? It was 22 years ago or something when he's talking to the cop in the Riverside. Oh, sorry, not in the Riverside, in the Ontario conference room. But that's I mean, that's not really like the end of what I consider to be the end of Jake Gyllenhaal stuff. The end of Jake Gyllenhaal stuff is the hardware store. And I can't remember where specifically that was placed in the '80s. But in the 70s or 80s, but it was just a weird way to structure this film, where you are carving up time in tiny minuscule increments and also huge swaths. And you're trying to tell interpersonal stories about the home lives that are impacted by this case, like Jake Gyllenhaal's home life, his kids who are alienated from him. He even has additional kids in the process of this investigation, because he had one son who was staying with him, and there was a baby who was with the mother, and then those two kids were with them later on. And there was also a daughter who was, I assume, from Chloe Sweeney.
I thought he had two kids when he met her, and then they had one together or something. I don't know. I don't remember.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
But we only saw one kid on screen initially because I think only the oldest son was staying with him.
Oh, right.
And the other,
on the couch and stuff.
Yeah, because when he talks about dropping, when he talks about the kid is going to go with his mom and stay with his brother, and he's like, oh, I don't like being with the brother, and he says, well, at least that's honest, you know? I think those two kids are from the previous marriage, and then the daughter is from Chloe Sweeney.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So there's not any real happy conclusion for where that goes in this film.
One of the text things said he now enjoys a very nice relationship with his wife and kids.
No, but on screen, where did that go? We got a whole thing even where they're being inducted into code cracking school, and they're his off screen partners when he's talking on the phone to the guy.
Yeah, it's really there just to show that he's devolved into a delusional person who is completely focused on this mystery to the point that he's making his kids help, like, plot out calendars of murders.
Yeah, so the story isn't about his home life. It is about this murder and about how obsessed he is. But I feel like it's a really clumsy way to emphasize his obsession in this manner. But
I mean, a lot of it's clumsy, but like, there aren't really a lot of other ways to represent, like, what was actually occurring while this stuff transpired. Like, you have to sort of show, like, all right, what would this guy have been doing whilst trying to investigate these things and figure it out? Like, I mean, this may well have been what his life looked like. So it's just like, well, there you go. I mean, the truth of the facts or something.
Yeah. Also, before we get any criticism, like, oh, this is, you know, just true facts stated. No, this is a movie that's been adapted. And so when you're adapting things, you have to decide what is germane to the story that you're telling narratively, in the adapted material. Not necessarily what is purely truthful, because what is purely truthful can be bad for the movie, and also undesirable in certain ways. And even when you're just telling things that are the truth, you still have to fill in all the blanks in order to make it a film. Because if you don't, then you just have a documentary of people that are reenacting things. Because that's just not a movie. That's how the animal crackers crumble, people. So don't sit out there all angry that I'm besmirching the Graysmith family. I'm not talking about the real family. I'm talking about the family as depicted on screen.
Yeah, I mean, you know, they had their weird little thing going on. They liked each other.
Okay.
It seems. Let's see. What else should we talk about in this movie? Are there any other... I don't know, but it's probably not worth getting into the plot because there are so many back and forths and turns out and police thingies that it's like, whatever. But we talked about the look of the movie. I liked the look of the movie. Did you enjoy the look of the movie?
I believe I had complained to you at a certain point that Chloe Sevigny was incredibly yellow. And yes. You had mentioned that this was because she was being lit with sodium vapor lights.
I mean, it's San Francisco in the 70s. Everything's just sodium vapor.
She's so yellow.
Mm-hmm.
Unpalatably so. There are interesting things in here and how things are lit and composed that I like.
Do you like that one super CG shot where it's above the cab and the cab stays centered in the frame and everything else moves?
No.
You didn't like it?
No.
It's pretty cool.
Okay. If you say so. But I do appreciate the craftsmanship that went into a lot of these driving comps and also...
What are you talking about? I don't know what you're talking about.
For people who might look at this and be like, what's CG? Or they might be like, oh, yeah, that Transamerica thing was totally CG. And it's like, yes, but there's more.
All CG.
There's so much. You see, David Fincher has a very particular way he would like things to be. And the best way to get things a very particular way is to...
Make them
from scratch.
you say like, make it look like this, and then they do it.
Yeah, and so they did. And if you go watch like the breakdowns that Digital Domain did for the visual effects work that they did on the film, you'd be like, what? That was a visual effects shot? Why is that? What is going on here? I thought that was a house. You watch it, and you're just like, oh, this is more complicated than I thought. And
I remember seeing that reel back in the day, too, and I was like, why is the whole street blue screen? Like, is this on a back lot? And like, well, not really. That doesn't make any sense.
Well, it's because he didn't want to close off a street for 4 days to film that.
Or you couldn't, or you wanted to get, like, a certain, like, you know, one street going downhill, one going uphill, or, like, whatever.
Yeah, so what?
Yeah, one goes one way, one goes the other way. You know, flexibility in terms of production, but like, yeah, there is a lot of stuff where you're like, wow, there's nothing there. There's a road and a cab, and then it's blue.
Yeah, no, and I really appreciate the work that went into making those things what they are on screen. And I will point out also that if you watch the VFX breakdown, the CG-ness of them seems more obvious than when you're watching the film. So watch the film first. If you're listening to this for some reason and were interested in the film, watch the film first. Then watch the breakdown and you'd be like, oh, that's interesting.
Some of it, I don't know, like, you know, when they freeze frame on like a key over black before they put the background behind it. Yeah, sort of. But like, I don't think any of it looks like terribly CG.
No. That's not what I mean. What I mean is... When you see the things come apart and put back together, then you know, and you can immediately dismiss it in your mind, like, oh, I knew that. But like, if you're watching the film, you're not going, oh, I knew that, because there's stuff that you just don't know intuitively in the context of the film. Nothing's really sticking out at you. Whereas if you're watching the breakdown immediately happen in real time, then yeah, you're going to notice that that was CG. And when you watch the film, you're going to try to pay attention for those things. But, I think you'd have a hard time finding it if you didn't know it was there. And there's even stuff like when the lady in the car is approaching from her perspective, the truck, and there's the other lady who had jumped out of the moving vehicle to escape the Zodiac Killer.
Right.
That lady is shot on a separate green screen from the truck driver, and the truck is CG and the road is CG, and all of the things are composited and put together. It's all fake. And they did, you know, they did a good job at doing all this stuff, and it's for composing the shot specifically the way that David Fincher wanted it composed. Like, that's why it's done that way, because that would have been very hard to actually shoot a shot like that. Now, there's other stuff where it's like, look at the third story of that house, where it's like, you know, that probably would not have been so difficult to shoot. Had you chose to do so. But,
I would very much like to know why they used blue screen instead of green screen. I can't think of any reason.
Well, I think for nighttime, it's better if you use blue screen, because you're going to wind up probably veering the footage towards blue, because blue is night in film language.
Yeah, but all of his stuff is still kind of greeny brown.
If you look at the night scenes, they're pretty blue.
Yeah.
They're like blue and light orange yellow.
I'm clicking on it right now. I don't know about that.
It's not Dean Cundey blue, but I can understand the reason why you would do that.
Shooting on a rather new experimental-ish digital camera, I wouldn't risk the added noise and difficulty keying just to shoot on a blue screen. Especially because all these blue screens are like terribly lit. Like there's like some of it's like 10% lit, and the other bits are like 70% lit. Makes no sense.
I'm sure they rotated the whole thing. But
Mark Ruffalo's hair would be very difficult to. Maybe not difficult because it's lumpy, no. But it's not really frizzy.
Yeah, I'm sure they luma keyed it, but there is stuff in here, especially when his hair like goes over the line of the screen, because there was just like a big black line in the middle of the screen because it's two screens put together. But anyway,
are you saying you see screen edges? No, in his hair?
I am saying that they wrote up that like there's no keying that would happen there because it'd be the same value. But there have been weirder choices that have been made in terms of blue or green screen than what goes on in this film.
But
once I worked on a movie where there was a main character who had blonde hair, and she would stand on green screens, and blonde hair that's brightly lit on a brightly lit green screen is unpleasant to key.
It's the same color. Yeah. is what it is.
Imagine everyone's surprise.
But nowadays, well, I guess I was about to say nowadays we know better, but we still get plenty of really dumb, badly shot footage nowadays. But like,
I dealt with some footage the other day where it was like a black velvet surface, like on that was lit, and because it's velvet, it catches light. It's not completely absorbent, and so you have gray splotches, and you're supposed to be pulling an element out of that, and it's like, why? Why do you do that? If it's supposed to be a luminance key, there should be no value. So why are you using something that catches highlights?
Did they think it was one of those like super black fabrics that absorbs all light, but it really didn't?
I would assume that was a thought that had crossed their minds. But if you looked at the footage that they filmed, that should have dissuaded them from that thought.
See, I went to film school with a guy who was determined to make a better color chart on his own time when he got out of it. So he bought all these like really fancy Epson printers, and he got all these color calibrators, and he went through like hundreds of different swatches of this like almost velvetish black fabric, and then like he built this weird thing that kind of has like a 90 degree angle, so it adds a little bit of shade to the black, and he's like, I can get this thing to 98% black as it reads through the camera, and all of my colors are properly calibrated. I'm like, wow, you spent a lot of time thinking about this. But there's all those like, you know, Reddit articles about some scientist developed a material that absorbs all light and doesn't bounce anything back.
Well, good for them.
Yeah,
it'll never be used
for your luma keying. It's probably very expensive.
Well, no, it'll never be used because nobody was using it before. And most of the time, what everybody does is what they've been doing for like the past 60 years. It's just inherited intelligence from whoever was doing the job before you, and nobody questions it, and it just continues.
Right. I'm just saying, for 2006-ish, whenever they shot this, released in 2007, it's a pretty bold move to go Viper for one and blue screen on a Viper for another thing.
Yeah. I would say that without having firsthand knowledge of what the footage looked like, it came out well. So
it did, good, yes.
Yeah. I have seen someone who had not a lot of experience with a digital camera, any digital camera, who was using a Red and was using it to shoot a blue screen in nighttime conditions and had underexposed everything. And that made a lot of problems for everyone.
I'm not even going to ask any leading questions to get the answers out of you, because I know what that looks like.
Yeah. Yeah. So if you ever want anybody to be happy with you ever again, make sure that you light your green screen or blue screen properly. I don't personally care which, just pick it. And also, if you have people wearing green, don't use a green screen. If you have people wearing blue, don't use a blue screen. These are just hints. These are clues. Try to think about these things before you set up your shots, people.
Yeah. Interestingly enough, I have to insert my own little bit of personal history into this. Back in NAB 2006 ish, I believe it's 2006. I was in one of the sessions back when I used to pay for sessions because I had an employer that would pay for that crap. I actually saw the Viper camera and these gigantic, like, mini fridge sized hard drives that they used to record all of the footage. And they were talking about how fancy uncompressed or whatever this film stream was. And then somebody like leaned over and was like, yeah, don't even bother like paying attention to this thing. Cause there's these weird guys over there that got this booth this year that are selling this 4K camera for $17,000. And I was like, yeah, get the hell out of here. That's never going to sell.
Was that red?
It was red. It was red.
Also, public service announcement. If you're ever like, wow, red is so great, it has so many Ks. No. What you want is an Alexa product. I don't care which one. Just pick one. Any of them.
I just got an email today from Red with a video explaining their Red code and why it's got a great data rate. It's got higher quality than competitors raw, as they call it. They did this nice little chart about data rate versus quality.
I got a question.
Mm-hmm.
Their leading competitor is, of course, Alexa.
Uh-huh.
And maybe under certain conditions where some specialist high-speed photography is used, maybe Phantom.
Maybe you could throw in like Blackmagic because they shoot Cinema DNG. It's not really raw, I guess.
Well, Blackmagic is Phantom.
No.
Yes.
Blackmagic is, or Phantom cameras are, Vision Research still, aren't they?
I thought it was Blackmagic.
I'm not Googling. In terms of like actual raw, Vision Research.
Oh, Vision Research. Okay.
Yes.
I stand corrected.
They're a scientific camera company.
Phantom is used in incredibly select scenarios. So most of the time you're talking about Alexa or Red. And I would personally, under all conditions, pick Alexa.
You and like everyone else, because every movie these days is shot on Alexa, basically.
Yeah, well, but here's the thing. If you're very strict about the number of Ks that are being used for things, you might be like, oh, they don't specifically have a camera that does these Ks exactly. So we need to use a different camera that does specifically these Ks, because part of the delivery specification is a camera that has these Ks. So let's get the Red Weapon 8XK 5000 billion or whatever.
You're sub-tweeting or sub-podcasting Netflix right now.
I am. So long story short, Netflix made it a technical decision that they were going to mandate that the output footage be, 4K DCP or DCI?
I think it's just UHD. It's 3840, 3860, whatever the hell UHD is. Not the 4096.
Yeah, but most of the RA Alexa stuff didn't actually meet that specification.
Right, so it's not just that the file format that comes out of the camera is UHD. It's that the sensor itself has UHD number of photo sites on it, which the Alexa does not. It has 3.2K, and then there's like some silly upresing that happens to make it 4K-ish.
Yeah. So that disqualified it from consideration for a lot of Netflix projects, and I think probably Amazon projects. And that led to Red cameras being used on some of those projects. And I will just say that every time I've used footage from a Red camera, it has had some bizarro technical weird oddities in it that you don't get from Alexa footage. Not enough that anyone in the audience would notice, but if you're working on the actual film, you'd be like, what? Like, how is motion blur doing this? what is that edge?
Do you get the stuff where this used to be the case back in the day where you would get some motion blur stuff, but all of the motion blur would be like in the blue channel and it would be non-existent in the other channels?
I believe I've seen similar things, yes. And also you get sometimes what seems almost like the focus is different. I don't know how to describe it between the different channels. It's like, why is this channel super sharp and then the other ones all have like a halo? This is incredibly bizarre.
Well, Joe, it depends on whether or not they had the skin tone OLPF in front of the sensor, if they had the low light OLPF.
I don't care. long story short, anyone who's ever going to shoot anything who's listening to this, please shoot it on Alexa, because other people who will be working on the footage that you're supplying will thank you. And you might even be the person working on that footage, so thank yourself. But yes, it is weird. And that is our long digression from the topic of the Viper camera.
Yeah, there's a way to make red stuff look good, but just don't. What was I going to say? Oh,
just,
yeah.
Just don't lock yourself into that.
It's a shame that Netflix is never going to be able to, you know, qualify Zodiac, because it was shot on the Viper camera, which is, not only is it, you can see where this camera landed in between technical innovations, because it is not a CMOS camera. Is it a 3CCD camera, if you can remember that technology? It is.
Nope, can't explain.
So there is a prism. As the light comes in, it is split into three different directions. There is a sensor that catches red.
That
there's
one?
A sensor that catches green, and a sensor that catches blue.
I forgot about that.
By default, it has a B4 bayonet camera mount on it, which is a news lens. You know, the ones that have the fun little integrated zoom controller, but you can take it off and you can put a DigiPrime thingy on it. It shoots uncompressed digital 444, 1920 by 1080. With a massive data rate, you say uncompressed to people and they're like, oh, that just means it's like it's not compressed real bad like the internet. No, this is absurdly large data rates. Uncompressed 444 is huge data rates.
Yeah, I believe it. I'm a little surprised that it maxes out at HD res, but
not only does it match out at HD res, it maxed out at 1080p 30 frames a second. It was the fastest it would go. It would shoot 1080i at, like, you know, 59.4 or whatever. But there's a reason that this movie, Zodiac, uses film for the slow motion shots, because the Viper camera just couldn't do it.
Yeah. I was wondering, in the end credits, there is a credit for Kodak and for Fujifilm. And I was like, why are there film credits? And for two different competing film companies.
I wonder if they shot Fuji, because it's got sort of that like brownish greenish yellow look, and then printed to Kodak for distribution. It says printed format Kodak, but no, it says negative format Kodak Vision 2 500T. So I don't see any mention of Fuji on IMDb, but I don't know, who cares.
Yeah, I saw it at the end credits of the film, but who knows.
Was it just the Fuji logo, or did it say Fuji film?
It said Fuji film.
It's possible that they used Zeiss DigiPrime lenses. I think were rehoused Fujinon lenses.
Oh, that's exciting. Anyway, this is the kind of information that everyone tunes in for.
Some people tune in for this.
Welcome to Lens Talk with Dan and Joe, where we talk about Fujinon rehoused lenses for the Viper camera.
The DigiPrimes were nice. Those were the ones that they tried to sell us for our Vericams, because they were, you know, like nice prime lenses, but for smaller sensor cameras. But they were just way too expensive and cost prohibitive for what you were going to do. And then again, the same time that this was all happening was when Red came out, and they're like, you know, screw it, stick a Canon DSLR lens on the front of it, it'll look great. And it's like, well, I can get a Super 35 4K sensor for $17,000, and I can stick a $500 lens on it, and it looks great compared to these like $20,000 DigiPrimes. Like, sign me up, man. And thus the race to the technological bottom began. And here we are, sitting in behind our desks.
We hit the bottom?
Shaking our heads at poorly lit blue screens.
Mm. Well, in any regard, I think this film is technically very pretty. Mm-hmm. And I don't mind that it's only HD, because I only have an HD TV, so it works for me, as they say in the biz. What I would be interested in is the feature proofness of this, and also let's say things like Michael Mann's catalog of early digital camera footage.
Collateral was partially shot with this camera, and Miami Vice was shot with this camera, I believe.
Yeah, because it was all low light stuff, so they had to do it digital instead of film, because it's the only way they could do it. But how great is that going to look in some time? And we'll find out, I guess.
You know,
I think it looks fine now.
Just do a TVI scale. It'll be fine.
Yes, yes. Just TVI scale everything.
Mm-hmm. And I would like to mention, I have confirmed that the actor who played Arthur Lee Allen does, in fact, play Jake Gyllenhaal's father in Bubble Boy.
Oh, my God. Are you for real?
I am for real.
Did they do that on purpose?
Well, Bubble Boy came first, so maybe, like, after Jake grew up and, like, you know, he had empty nest syndrome, he kind of, like, lost his wits about him, and then
Dan,
the Zodiac killer.
Dan. Was that the casting that they did on purpose, or did it just happen that they cast that way?
It's the Zodiac Cinematic Universe, Joe.
Oh, my God. I know you're trying to get me to watch Bubble Boy, but this is not winning me over right now.
Arthur Lee Boy and his son Bubble. Thank you. Good night.